Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, Karen Nussel and Loren Cox join us to discuss why we need cross-partisanship in education reform. Then, on the Research Minute, Amber reports on a new study examining the effects of co-requisite remediation on achievement and retention for college students. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Republican governors are the champions of teacher pay. What's going on there?
Yeah, it polls really well.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guests for this week, Loren Cox and Karen Nussel. Loren is the policy director at the Aspen Institute, and Karen is the founder and CEO of Ripple Communications. Loren and Karen, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
I know Karen so well from our time together fighting the Common Core Wars of 2013 and 2014. And I look back on those days strangely fondly.
As do I. It was fun.
Yes. Good, good, good.
We did good stuff.
We did indeed, but the good stuff has not ended. You and Loren have been leading an effort over there at the Aspen Institute that has been trying to, shall we say, build bridges in education, not too unlike a project that I led last year called the Building Bridges Initiative. You all came out with a great new report, and we're going to talk about it today. So let's do that on Ed Reform Update. Okay, so Karen, tell us about this project and then about this call for what you say is a cross-partisan approach to education.
Yeah, so Loren and I have been engaged in this work for quite a while now, and our work has been an effort to discover how we might find ways to build broader coalitions of support in ed policy initiatives. And I like to say that Loren is the D to my R. So we come at this from a bipartisan or cross-partisan perspective. And what we've been doing for about a year now is having a lot of conversations. We did some informal focus grouping with people doing the work in the field about what they were finding that was actually working. And we ended up with some ideas about a potential new, call it a strategic framework for how advocates might think about doing the work, because there are some themes that emerged in our conversations and there are some things getting done. So we looked out at the landscape and examined how are these efforts succeeding? And what we found is that while there is some nostalgia about this notion of bipartisanship, about the way things used to be done in education, where people went into a room, they negotiated a little bit of give and take. They came out, said to their side, well, hey, we didn't get everything, but we did something for the greater good. And that in and of itself was a win, the fact that they could work together and do something in a bipartisan way. That's no longer the case in our political climate. Bipartisanship is seen as weak or as a capitulation to the other side, rather as a goal in and of itself. And so what we're trying to suggest is that people take a look at what we're calling a way to do things that's cross-partisan. So think about the way that music artists cross over the lines of their genres, and that you can still get people from both sides to agree to a particular policy, but they may be doing it for their own reasons, not for the collective reason of bipartisanship as it's traditionally known.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Loren, is this something that you think we need to do at both the state and federal level? I mean, to my mind, there's no doubt in Washington, right? It's just impossible because of the way that Congress now has become more of a platform for people to get on cable news and on social media and to on the right to own the libs, or on the left to, you know, whatever the left likes to do to conservatives, and so it's really hard to get people. You're right. They can't even be seen working together. I don't know. You know, in Ohio, where we do a lot of work on the ground, it feels like it's still not quite as bad, although frankly, you know, the way that that state works, the Democrats really have very little power. So there's also not bipartisanship. I'm just curious, is this a Washington problem or is this happening all over the place?
I think that it's happening all over the place, but like you said, kind of to varying degrees. But also, I think that the examples that we're pulling from of where this can happen is mostly at the state level already. Mm-hmm. So what we're saying is, even if there's not as much polarization, or maybe there's some places where one party just doesn't have any power, so they don't need to be compromising in any way, the advocates on the ground are already doing this kind of work. And so that's actually where we were able to pull from to even come up with this idea about how do you move things forward. I would also say that I've been able to do, in a related body of work, talk to a lot of advocates on the ground since working on this with Karen. And they're saying, okay, this is really helpful. You know, we've been trying to figure out how to move certain things. Even education has become so polarized. I'm not sure exactly what to do in my state or even in their locality sometimes. And so I do think it's a broader problem and not just in Washington.
Okay. So Karen, can you give us some examples in education reform? What are some of these cross-partisan issues where people are getting things done?
Yeah. So I think the big one that I think most of your listeners will be familiar with is the science of reading. So here's a situation where a lot of things happened to make a lot of awareness happen and a lot of policy change happened very quickly around the science of reading. But if you look at the politics of it, each side sort of did it for their own reasons. And so I think we like that example because there's a lot of things we can talk about with that example. But the bottom line is, if you look at this notion of cross-partisanship, they didn't come together because they were like, oh yeah, this is a kumbaya moment and we should all link arms and let's do the science of reading. No, each side basically came and said, yeah, we'll do this because it's good for our side. It's good for the arguments that we like to make and that animates our base for certain reasons. So I think that's one really good example. Another example, I think, would be civics. We're seeing a lot of movement on civics in a lot of states, and it looks different in different places. But again, this is a topic where, you know, politically, if you just look at the raw politics of it, people are coming together for reasons that are really different, but they're still arriving at the same destination. They may be taking a different road to get there, but they're still getting to yes. And I think that's the point we're trying to make.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I am still trying to get my head around this a little bit. And the science of reading example is interesting. I mean, I guess the way I thought of it was that the success this round was that for some reason, it does not have as conservative a valence as it used to be. That there, you know, back in the year 2000 and in the 1990s, you know, the idea of teaching phonics was branded somehow as a conservative thing, even a Christian right thing. And maybe, you know, because you've got, you know, everything that's been happening coming more from the left, the concerns about the reading, you know, especially all the great programs we've been hearing on NPR and, you know, from a trusted source that's considered, you know, it just wasn't something that was being led, at least originally this round, by conservatives. And so it gave room for Democrats to get behind it, you know, which is almost like the best lesson there may be for conservatives is like on some of these issues, just stay quiet. Like, just don't try not to make it, you know, don't try not to be out front on this one and let the people on the left take the lead.
Yeah. I mean, if you can make those dynamics happen, I definitely think that's something that advocates should look at, of like who takes the lead matters, then think about that. But I think, I mean, and I'll let Loren speak to this on the left, but I think where we came down was like, look, Republicans got to say, look, we were right all along. And they got to have that sort of ego boost of like, we were right about this from the beginning. But on the left, they were able to say, look, we think this matters for equity reasons. And so that's why we're going to be for it. It also didn't hurt that there were a lot of teachers who came out as a part of the Sold a Story podcast and that whole investigative reporting series, that there were a lot of teachers who all of a sudden were like, well, wait a minute. I never saw this data before, or I wasn't aware of the science. And so that sort of gave some political cover, I also think, on the left, but I would like Loren to actually
speak. No, and it just to me interesting, right? That 20 years ago, it was George W. Bush out front on this issue,
right?
Right. And now it's Emily Hanford and NPR, right? That makes a difference.
I do think the messenger makes a difference. That's something that has been true in the past and will be true, I think, forever. But the difference here as to when I think about if we were trying to do this in a more traditionally bipartisan way is that before there would have been a place where we were all trying to come together, which would have meant the left having to say, we were wrong. We did overlook that research 20 years ago. Because that coming together is not celebrated anymore, or even, you know, doesn't even feel possible, we're kind of allowed to go into our own, you know, sides. And like Karen said, to our side, say, this is an equity win. Let's just move it forward, because there's no incentive for us to be like shaking hands in front of the camera and signing things together. And so it's not that the outcome is different. I think it's more of the process. And Mike, I heard you say like you're still struggling getting your head around it. One of the examples that I think about that are not in the, it's not in the brief, but just to try to make the distinction between the two. So I used to work for Unidos US. We did a lot of work around Title III and English language acquisition. We always had different talking points to our Republican friends and to our Democratic friends, right? Always. They were always different, talking about what was important or resonating with the values of each. But we had to figure out how to get them to come together and work on it together to move things forward. We don't have to do that now. We now just get to give each of them their talking points. They can say it to their base. No one pays attention about whether they worked on it together or not. And it moves forward without kind of the pushback that I think it would get if they were like taking pictures, shaking hands, talking about what they were doing for English learners.
Gotcha. David, what do you think?
Well, I have a question. Do you think it requires more supermajority support these days than it used to? Or are we simply framing that differently? I mean, my assumption is that all the things you're describing are things for which whatever it is, it has to have supermajority support. And it's like somehow we have to get it, you know, to not admit to that fact, right? Not admit that we agree about it. And, you know, we'll just pass it despite, you know, sort of because we disagree or in some up is down sort of way, we both get to claim victory. I guess I'm just trying to line that up with, you know, what I think I've heard or seen in polls about like actual the substance of the issues, right? Where it does actually seem like there's been a little bit of separation on multiple issues in the general public. I mean, I guess my point is, did bipartisanship, do you think it always required the sort of super majority support that is required for these sorts of things? Has anything changed substantively about what people feel? Or is it just a sort of a new branding?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure this is going to answer your question, but I think the way I would approach it is, you know, I think the public is in a different place than the electeds are, right? Like the extremes on both sides are what the electeds are responding to. And so you have to take that into consideration, even if the majority of the voting public is somewhere more in the middle. And so this extremism is what's causing, I think, the field to feel like they can't move because they don't know how to navigate things that are that far apart. And so I think what we're telling them is like I said earlier, there's a way to get to the same destination. You just may have to travel different roads to get there. And it's like look, take teacher pay as an example. You now have a bunch of Republican governors who are the champions of teacher pay increases. What's going on there? Right? I mean,
yeah, it polls really well. That's what's going on there.
I think I'm just struggling with the level of doublethink that's required to, you know, to make any of this make sense, right? Mike, maybe we should agree less explicitly and we'll just pretend that we're saying different things, even when we're obviously saying the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's always like, okay, cross-partisanship is bipartisanship, but without the big signing ceremony, you know, or the hoopla.
I feel like yes and no. I mean, so there is a little bit of that to it, but they are also saying different things. There is a different appeal to the policy for each side, and that is a little bit different. It used to be that they could come to some agreement on the general appeal of the policy and the why. The why is now can now be really different for each side, even though they agree that the policy is the right thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. All right. That is good. Hey, we could talk so much more about this, but that is all the time we've got. But people should definitely go and read your brief. We will link to it from our website. But until then, thank you guys so much for coming on the show. Loren Cox from the Aspen Institute, Karen Nussel at Ripple Communications. We have got to have you back on sometime soon.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. The word is cross-partisanship, not bipartisanship anymore. There you go.
Huh.
You heard it here first.
Everybody's cross, Mike. That's
right. Yes. Okay. Hey, look, we were saying this the other day, like how many of our debates are really just fights over language? Look, if different language helps us get stuff done, that's fine. That's fine. All right, Amber, what you got for us this week?
We got a new study out from researchers at the University of Delaware. We're looking at developmental or remedial education in community colleges. Woo, we need this study. How that's changed in the last decade or so, and whether it's been more or less beneficial for students. Let's get a quick primer on how remedial education has changed. It used to be in higher ed, they mandated students who were below college-ready thresholds. It's typically measured by ACT or SAT scores. They had to pass a sequence of remedial courses, up to 3 courses, before they could enroll in college-level coursework. But alas, this turned out to be somewhat ineffective, in part because there were high attrition rates and many complaints that the remedial courses didn't cover the college-level course content all that well. So in recent years, more than 20 states have now adopted a co-requisite model of remediation, which allows remedial students to take college-level courses at the same time they are taking courses that provide them with academic supports to pass that college-level course. So the idea is that the kids are getting just-in-time support, is what they call it, that may benefit them more versus this longer timeline that we used to do that was intended to build up their skills to these prerequisite sequences of remedial courses. Okay? That's the theory. The study takes place in Tennessee, which was the first higher education system to replace their standalone prerequisite sequence with a co-requisite model for all incoming students as of 2015. So, hey, we've got the perfect set of circumstances for a DIF and DIF model. They're also used some event study techniques. So they're comparing the outcomes of remedial students with similar placement scores before and after the co-requisite implementation, using changes in the outcomes of the college-ready students during the same time period to control for general time trends or shocks from other policy changes. Then they've got all these controls for student demographics, including placement test scores, high school GPA, race, age at college entry, and so on and so forth. They're also able to look across the below college readiness distribution to see which groups of students may be more or less impacted by the change. We got about 200,000 students who are first time in college students involved in the Tennessee Board of Regents system. That's about 13 community colleges and 24 applied technical colleges. On average, let me just take myself a little breath here and ask you guys, on average, what percentage of students do you think were assigned to remediation for at least one subject during that time period?
30%.
80%.
75%, David.
I got him.
God, 75. Are you
75%.
We're recording this, right?
Yes, we are.
Yes.
Point for David. All right, so on to the findings. We got a mixed bag here. On the positive side, students placed into co-requisite remediation were 20.4 percentage points more likely to complete gateway math by the end of year one, compared with otherwise similar students placed into that prerequisite remediation. So this was a 75% improvement from the baseline average of the prerequisite cohorts. In addition, the co-requisite remediation had significant positive effects on first-year gateway completion rates for remedial students in all test score groups. So along that whole distribution that were all below that college-ready threshold. And for math, the effect was strongest for the highest scoring remedial students. In English, the pattern was reversed. The lowest scoring students experienced the greatest improvement. And then they dug a little bit deeper and they said, okay, students in these co-requisite cohorts were also significantly more likely to enroll in and pass a second college level course in math and English by the end of year two. And then they say, well, these positive effects on this college credit accumulation were primarily structural because the co-requisite approach removes the delay, right, and access to these college level credits. But at the same time, kids have fewer total credits, which is going to come back to haunt us in a second. The long-term results, so now we move on to the farther out. Oh, they weren't good. They found that remedial students, particularly those with lower placement scores, were more likely to drop out and less likely to earn short-term certificates. So, for example, remedial students under the co-requisite era or regime were 4.3 percentage points more likely to drop out of college, partly driven by these fewer number of total credits attained because they were taking fewer developmental courses. And also the average grade in college level math, this is both in the gateway and the advanced courses, for remedial students went from 1.9 in the prerequisite era to 1.5 for the co-requisite cohorts. And the share of those who failed any of these courses increased from about 37% to 50%. So the takeaway after all that seems to be that replacing the old model of development education with a new one carries its own risk. Doesn't seem to be a silver bullet to addressing unprepared students. At least that was my takeaway.
Well, Amber, yes, no silver bullet. You know what would be a silver bullet, in my opinion? Make sure that every institution of higher education in this country has at least some kind of admissions standard, right? Don't admit kids who are three grade levels behind below grade level in reading or math, and encourage them to spend their money at your institution or spend the federal government's money when they're not nearly prepared.
Even at the technical colleges, Mike?
Even at the technical college. Well, I mean, assuming that we're talking about things that are, that take decent levels of math and literacy. I mean, I don't know. Look, I know that's a harsh position, but it just drives me crazy that there's, people will bash for-profit colleges all the time. And for many good reasons. I think generally a lot of them are bad actors, right? For taking people's money and they don't graduate and they just have debt. But so do a lot of these other colleges. If you take somebody who has very, very low levels of math and literacy, I'm sorry. No, I don't think higher education is the place for them. I don't think that's necessarily a crazy notion. Now, I did want to understand, because you were saying that in math, it sounded like the low scoring students did not do as well. But what was the finding on English? Was it saying that kids with low test scores in English did decently?
It was the lowest scoring students experienced the greatest improvement in English.
Okay. Right. But the long-term findings, it sounds like, still were pretty disappointing.
That's right. Yep. In terms of the dropout rates.
Yeah. Okay. So I just want to make sure I understand the intervention. It's an additional course that you're taking that is sort of supporting the course that you're maybe not quite ready for?
At the same time, you're getting just-in-time support to take the other course. That's the college credit course to a non-college credit course.
Okay, and this additional course, I'm just trying to understand. Like, so if you're not ready for Algebra 1, you're taking pre-algebra simultaneously.
That's right, something to that effect. Yes,
or tutoring. I mean, I think of it like some of the high schools where they double up on math,
right?
And that other math period might be more tutoring. Basically,
well, that's my question, right? Like, is it really another course, or is it tutoring, or what is it actually?
Yeah, it's a good question. They said supports, right? But in other places, they do give the example of sort of a prerequisite math course for a higher math course. So I don't know if it could be either, frankly. They don't really make that clear.
Okay. And then that's helping them pass the course, which makes some sense if it's just like sort of you're getting credits for additional tutoring, right? But then we're saying that it ultimately leads to less credit accumulation because, ironically, you've gotten to more advanced material more quickly. And so you basically top out.
Well, you've gotten right. Because you haven't had to take the developmental courses, you've gotten more college. You've gotten to the college level courses more quickly. Yes.
Yes. And you're not ready for them. So in order for you to, right, you can't get your credits by taking a bunch of courses that aren't really college courses. Man, this is a funny game we play, isn't it?
Except it's not funny, right?
It's not funny, but it is. It's like some sort of bizarre shell game, right? Where the only way to give them a college credit is by not giving them credit for things that aren't college. And then we say, you know, completion rates have gone up. But then I'm supposed to think it's bad when they've dropped out of a college, you know, an institution they weren't ready for to begin with, right? I don't know. Maybe it's good, Mike. Maybe it's good that they're failing more quickly if where they belong.
I think that's right. I mean, I just this week was hearing, you know, people wringing their hands about some of these trends, saying that fewer young people are going to college. The colleges, of course, don't like this. And look, if it includes young people who are well prepared to succeed in college or are on the bubble and with a little support, they could be successful. Yes, those people should go to college. We know that there's still a huge payoff from college. But, you know, there are kids who aren't anywhere near that bubble who have been for the last 20, 30 years. We've been telling them to go to college. And we know, we can predict it with great precision. They are not going to make it. They are going to drop out. And so if we can convince those kids to do something else with their time, I think that's a win. Or in this case, they're going to hit the wall sooner and then they're going to drop out faster. But why put them through this? I mean, and I get it. We hate the idea that somebody is going to determine that some kid is not ready when maybe they could be. And we know in the past, those decisions have been made based on the color of kid's skin and based on their zip code and based... So I get the impulse, but we need to balance that aspiration with some reality, which is that there's a whole bunch of people out there who we are not succeeding in getting to college readiness by the time they're 18. And, you know, encouraging them to go to college is a really bad piece of advice.
I mean, so is the answer that we need more high quality apprenticeships to bridge the divide, you know, between high school and no college and a job?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that what the good news is that there are some good, talent finder kinds of assessments out there where you help young people find out what they are good at. And it may not be math and literacy, but it may be other skills that have value in the labor market. I think then helping them, you know, figure out if there may be some certificate programs or other things to help them make the most of that. That makes sense. But Amber, the real issue is we got to teach kids to read and do math when they're in first grade. You know, that's the answer in my
opinion. Well, and Mike, the other fundamental problem here is we're focusing on degree completion instead of learning, right? I mean, we don't do that in the lower grades, right? But when we get to the higher grades, it's hard to measure learning, right? When we get to the college level. Right. And so we wind up focusing on degree completion, which inevitably leads to weirdness around, well, OK, you know, how can we get more kids to complete this degree? Well, we can water it down. You know, I mean, I don't know. We're not going to be able to help kids by giving them useless degrees, and we're not going to be able to give them degrees that are useful, you know, if they're not ready. So we have to center the conversation around, are they actually learning? I don't have a problem with a 19-year-old taking a remedial writing or math class, because ultimately the idea is that has some utility after, you know, like in the real world, or what's the point of any of this, right? But we have to be able to measure their actual learning, right? It can't just be that they sat in class for a semester and then they got a grade and we have no idea. I mean, it has to actually be real.
All right, folks. Well, hey, that is all the time we've got. But thank you, Amber. That was really interesting.
Yep.
But until next week,
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.